Welcome to In Layers, where we explore the people and technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green. We're back with our second Decoded episode of the year, and we have so much to cover. We have big news coming out of DeepSeek, Allen Institute of AI, DeepMind, Meta, and even Minecraft. Yes, Minecraft. To help me cover it all, I'm joined by two of my amazing Kung Fu AI colleagues, my co-founder and distinguished engineer, Dr. ZZ Tsai, and our VP of Engineering, Michael Wharton. All right, Michael, ZZ, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
All right, we've got so much to talk about today. It's actually going to be challenging to chew through all this, but I'm going to jump in right away. The DeepSeek R1 model was released, I think, just a couple days after we filmed the last episode.
Wait, what's that?
Yeah, you haven't heard about it? and it's actually, I was really bummed in the beginning because I thought, oh, we missed a chance to talk about it. But I actually think this is good because it's been almost a month. Yeah, it definitely gave me a chance to kind of really think about it and collect my thoughts on it. And so lots to talk about here. So set the table. Obviously, DeepSeek is a Chinese-based AI company. They released this model called R1 in late January, and about a week later, the markets melted down. NVIDIA stock was down, I think, $600 billion on that Monday. And to put that in perspective, that's more than the market cap of AT&T and Verizon combined, you know, which is just kind of mind-blowing. The market freaked out because the R1 paper said that they were able to train this very, very powerful state-of-the-art reasoning model for about $5 million, which that's a lot of money, but it's, you know, pennies compared to the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars that other frontier labs have spent on reasoning models. The fear within the market was, oh, this means we won't need as much compute. That's why NVIDIA got hit. Mm-hmm. Some of the other, power-related stocks were hit as well. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was just an absolute, you know, mistake on the market because we won't go into this much, but the performance of R1 is going to drive demand for compute. It's going to drive demand for power because it's going to make reasoning models easier to deploy and there's going to be more, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so let's talk about why R1's important. R1's important because, yes, it was relatively inexpensive to train, but that's also because they kind of stood on the shoulders of models before, right? They were able to leverage things like Llama. The R1 is actually DeepSeek's V3 model base that was then fine-tuned to become a reasoning model. What is really interesting about this, in my opinion, is the four-stage training methodology that they use, which we'll talk about here a little bit, but then the emergent reasoning capabilities, right? And first off the bat, do you guys agree with that so far? I mean, I think the emergent abilities here are the most important.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it's a surprise that because people tend to think reinforcement learning models are hard to train, are hard to tame. It's hard to get the data for it because the rewards tends to be sparse. But
right,
you know, R1 kind of showed that it's easier than a lot of people thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it seems like this is just another flavor of the same statement, but I feel like the more powerful our base models, the more easy it'll be to train subsequent more powerful emergent capabilities and whatever else. And I think that's like, it's pretty crazy to think about.
Okay, so you,
'cause we're on the upswing, you know.
That is literally one of the main points I want to make today. I'm going to talk about this over and over again, but I think that's one of the most important things about R1 is that it showed that some of these techniques, reinforcement learning, which we're going to come back to a lot today, maybe some of the troubles we had with them in previous years was just we didn't have a model with enough capabilities to really benefit from that. Mm-hmm. So, all right, so let's really quickly run through this. So the R1, they used a four-stage training. There are a couple of things that are important. They used cold start data of chain of thought. So that means that they took this base V3 model and they first trained it, I think they said, on several thousand, like 5,000 to 8,000 chain of thought examples. That means chain of thought where the input is really sort of reasoning in a way through the results. It's not actually a reasoning model. It's not going back and rethinking its output, but it's just clearly reasoned processes, text that were that it was trained on. And that was to get this base model sort of able to do this sort of chain of thought reasoning. Then they had the second phase to use something called reasoning-oriented reinforcement learning. And, and they used a new type of RL technique called GRPO, which stands for, where is it? I've got it here in my notes somewhere, where it's like group reinforcement policy optimization. And what's interesting about that is instead of looking at each result individually, they looked at groups of results. Okay. And we have so much to cover here. I'm not going to go into that, but that was an efficiency mechanism that worked pretty well. Then they did rejection sampling and supervised fine tuning. And then finally, the fourth stage was they did this diverse reinforcement learning phase where they trained on a combination of sort of verifiable and human feedback tasks. The most interesting thing to me are the first two stages. The chain of thought, I think that really made a big difference. Where did they get these chain of thought examples? Distillation, I think there's a lot of evidence that, again, they're standing on the shoulders of the previous work. This was not really just a $5 million trained model. But they used verifiable RL in this second phase, and I think that's huge. That means they were able to train at scale on certain tasks that were verifiable. Math and coding were the main two, where they trained not only to get the right answer, but it had to be in the right format. Mm-hmm. Okay. With all of that, you know, not to bury the lead, but the amazing thing is that the performance of R1 was on par with O1, which OpenAI released, in October timeframe, give or take. And, you know, it was flagship reasoning model at the time. This has similar performance. And the emergent reasoning abilities that we've already talked about a little bit here are what's amazing. All of a sudden, the model had what they call these aha moments, where it's outputting tokens as a part of answering the prompt, and it would reflect. It would say, oh, wait, I think I've made a mistake, or there was a contradiction. Let me go back and change and think about my results. And the model's performance was amazing. All right, to kind of put a bow on this, I think this is a really, really important thing for a couple of reasons. One is, I'll be honest, I was really impressed with auto-regressive models and how far they had scaled, you know, but quote, we're running out of data. How much further could we push this? This sort of almost recursive reflection that the model now is capable of with these verifiable RL methods really feels to me like this reasoning model was achieved in an emergent way. And it's kind of gotten me thinking that we're moving into this future where all future models, all future really important foundational models are going to be trained on the basis of and by the previous generation's model, right? We're going to kind of bootstrap ourselves up. What do you guys think about that? Am I crazy?
So in my opinion, I do think it feels like a paradigm shift marked by the OpenAI's O series reasoning models and also the R1 from DeepSeek. I don't know whether you agree with that or not, but I feel like before DeepSeek R1 was released, there was a lot of speculation about how the O1 worked.
Yes.
And in our last episode, actually, I was talking about this by reading from some papers. People thought, hey, maybe there are some search-guided reasoning process, where it's, you know, human-programmed search process like MT.
And meaning at inference, it's not just outputting token, it's doing some type of search.
Right, exactly. Like the AlphaGo type of search.
Right.
You know, try this path. If it doesn't work, try another path. I think OpenAI somehow at that time, I remembered it said something like, hey, no, it's a simple LLM. There's no such search. There's no intentional.
That's right.
It's just the intuition machine
that
spits out the next token.
Right.
And people are like, is that real? And then DeepSeek R1 was out, and it is a LLM, just an LLM.
Pure autoregressive LLM.
No intentional reasoning at all.
No.
Just coming out from the next token predictor, which is, I think, is very surprising.
Really, you don't think that that has something to do with the fact that, I mean, it seems like some of the most impactful problems have really sparse rewards just in the natural world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you don't have a powerful enough base model that can at least like find the direction you're going in the lost landscape, then, you know, minimizing your error is pretty hopeless. But I hadn't really thought about that until now, but is that...
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I do think you need some sort of base model capabilities, and that's the reason, and mm-hmm. I do want to hear what you think, mm-hmm. Susie, but that is the reason I think this happened. I think we see this emergent behavior only at this frame, mm-hmm. at this time frame, because the models are finally powerful enough that they can push beyond and have this emergent ability. Now, that's super hand-wavy. I realize that, but that's sort of the nature of emergence. But yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I do think that, and people have showed that a strong enough model is needed, a base model is needed for RL to work. In my opinion, I feel like, you know, the base model should be able to at least know what reasoning looks like and be mm-hmm. able to mimic it. So that's why I think, you know, Ron, when you describe the training sequence of the R1, it's multiple steps. It's first,
that's right.
you know, mm-hmm. doing supervised fine-tuning on chain of thoughts.
That's right.
That people
with so few examples, too. I mean, you said it's right. a couple thousand or something, right?
Right. Yeah. And also, it's just, you know, just using math and coding. And then the model gained reasoning capability on other fields too. That's surprising.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
there must be some meta reasoning structure that the model has learned.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I wasn't going to linger on this, but I completely agree. And I think that the reason that math and coding as that base verifiable training set was so important is it essentially forced the model to become good at sort of analytical thinking. You know, thinking in a sort of measured, thoughtful, stepped way. And the other thing I should mention, which is really, really important, is they explained how they trained it. That's huge. That mm-hmm. was, this might be the single most important thing, was that they published their sort of their recipe. And up to this point, nobody really knew how OpenAI did this or how reasoning models might have been trained. They laid it all out, and we're already seeing this, and I know we're going to get to this mm-hmm. later. We're seeing replication of this in the open source community. So,
yeah.
Okay, fantastic. All right, I'm going to throw it to you, Michael, for the next topic.
And this is going to be a long episode. All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about, I guess there's probably a little bit of a theme here, but, you know, Jan LeCun has been pushing this idea of joint embedded predictive architectures for years now. And the idea is that, you know, one of the biggest limitations of generative models is that they don't really have an intuitive understanding of physics. You know, I think we've all seen that the Sora video of the ballerina that sprouts new legs as it spins and does some crazy stuff. But, you know, if you squint and look from a distance, it still matches the distribution of natural, you know, images, video, et cetera, that we're used to seeing. But they have this paper that's specifically applying this technique to video now that they've applied to images and other domains in the past. This is a mouthful. Get ready. It's called Intuitive Physics Understanding Emerges from Self-Supervised Pre-Training on Natural Videos.
This rolls off the tongue.
I know. It's so nice and smooth. But I think, you know, before jumping into the details, I think it makes a lot of sense to look at it in the context of what Meta as a company is doing right now. You know, last week, there was an internal memo that was released saying that they were starting this internal, like, humanoid robot research division. And, you know, we just saw that release, I think, yesterday, the day before, from Figure. You know, a lot of people are really focused on humanoid robots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that RL is becoming a lot more powerful in ways that we hadn't predicted before. You know, all this stuff is kind of converging. But you can imagine that a really deep intuitive understanding of a world model, of a physical understanding of the world, is important for base models to have before we can build these complex behaviors that interact with the world. So basically what they did, it's not crazy at all. It's pretty simple. So what they did is they had an encoder model, and it's all transformer-based, as you might imagine, vision transformer-based. And they have an encoder model, and then they have a predictor model. And what they're doing is, at the same time they're trying to embed a natural video, they're corrupting that natural video and getting a corrupted embedding with the same network. And then they're training this predictor to predict the error between the embeddings. Does that make sense?
Between the embeddings, not between the pixels, right?
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so it differs from something like a mass autoencoder where you know, try to predict the error at the, you know, in the space of the inputs. But the interesting thing there is it's biologically inspired. You know, one of the leading theories of cognition is that, you know, the error signal that your brain attaches to when you learn is errors in your predictions of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're trying to minimize surprise over time,
right?
You know, like common threads with active inference and
exactly.
stuff like that.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. But really, this is kind of just a biologically inspired way of doing that with modern deep learning techniques. And the cool thing is it works. So they have a couple of different benchmarks, and there's some hand wavy here I want to pick on a little bit too, but there are three benchmarks that they looked at. One's called INTFIS, one's called GRASP, and the other one's INF-Eval Lab, I think. Yeah, yeah. The INTFIS one I think is really interesting because they went from, you know, if you compare it with any other model that they tested against, those models do a little bit better than chance, where they're trying to predict, you know, is a particular video versus another one more physically plausible.
Oh,
you know, yeah. They're pairwise comparisons, and they're trying to figure out, is this video or is this one, you know, more physically plausible. On INTFIS, they scored 98%, and all the next leading candidate was about 63%. So it's a pretty big leap.
That's huge. Yeah, that is.
And if you look at the videos, they're just like, you know, really silly computer graphics of like basic geometric shapes moving through the world with basic kinematics, moving past occlusions, you know, stuff that as a human, you see something.
And you instantly know.
You're like, oh yeah, it's got the same trajectory when it comes up from the other side. My mental model says that it was moving behind it the whole time.
Right.
You know, models struggle with that kind of thing. But the, it's so hand wavy how they did it. So they measured surprise with their architecture. You know, they're measuring prediction error of future frames. But with these other architectures, they basically provided both videos as input to modern multimodal language models and then just prompted and asked which one's more physically plausible.
Oh, okay.
So it's a total apples to oranges kind of comparison.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Which I'm surprised they're... I mean, yeah. It's interesting, but it's apples to oranges.
I totally agree. That doesn't really seem meaningful.
Yeah. But there is one architecture they compared to called Video MAE. And that one is, you know, it's meant to be a video understanding model and has a pretty similar purpose. And they were able to evaluate it in much more of a similar way. Okay. And that one was basically chance at every step.
Okay.
So there's something happening there. I think it's interesting. But... you know, Jan LeCun's chasing this JEPA dream. We'll see how it pans out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Yeah. My first thought is I feel like there's more and more activity recently where we're talking about moving up the compute ladder into like the embedding space where we're doing things. We're doing things almost. More internally within the model than for example here in the pixel space or whatever maybe or the token space for LLMs, and that is really really interesting because I you know I can't help but think that's probably more analogous to the way our own brains actually work as well.
Mm.
Right. All right. That's fantastic, Michael.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this direction. Thanks for sharing, Michael. And you know. Understanding a model's capability around not just generating the observation of the world, like, you know, video is an observation of the world, but rather also the driving principle, the first principles behind the observation of the world. Just find it to be super exciting. And intuitive physics is a great benchmark from Josh Tenenbaum and others from MIT. It has been there, but, you know, intuitive is like, you know, modeling human's intuition about, hey, does the box fall? How would it fall? You know, which way does it fall to be more plausible? That's a really great benchmark. Yeah, I'd just love to see more work in this direction.
Yeah, same here.
All right, ZZ, what do you got for us?
So my first topic is very similar to yours, Ron, also related to RL. I personally have been paying more attention in the more like cost-effective training recipes. And there's this work that's recently shared that I think cost roughly $5,000 to train using reinforcement learning a pretty small model, like 1.5 billion parameter model. It's big.
Yeah, can't believe that's small enough.
Yeah, small for today.
I remember when billions was big.
Yeah
exactly.
Yeah. And now it's tiny. And it surpasses O1 preview on mass tests. So the you know, about 4,000 A100 GPU training hours. They take the base model. The base model is a Q1 model, based on Q1 architecture distilled from R1. So that's the base. And then from the base, you apply RL with the verifier using you know, previous math problems. Amy, it's a pretty challenging, like, you know, math competition for the smartest high school students. You know, they use the data from the 1980s up on to 2023 as the training data, and then they tested on the next year's mass contest and got to like 43% on that benchmark, whereas O1 preview was 40%. So that's already surpassing O1 preview, which people, you know, don't really believe is a much larger model.
Zizi, so, what was the name of this model?
So I don't know the exact name of the model name. It's probably very long. Okay. If I were to guess, it must be DeepSeq R1 Distill Q1 1.1B RL, something like that. Gotcha. Yeah. But, you know, it's the name also very informative because it tells you what's the source of the model, which is also very interesting. But what's surprising to me is that, you know, now the cost is $5,000 to match the frontier that was like, because O1 preview was released within last year.
Right? Oh yeah, absolutely. So I mean, yeah. Within 6 months. So
yeah,
incredible.
And also that you can go down to 1.5B model.
That's a really good point. I think I missed that initially. So it's not just that it's got this incredible sort of state of the art mathematical capabilities, but just single digit billion parameter space.
Right.
That's huge because you can run it locally.
Yeah, you can run that locally, easily run that locally.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Wanted to add that, you know, it's not the state of the art. There, you know, much bigger model will still score much higher on that. Like, you
right.
know, I think the current, like Grok 3 was at 90% now on that same test, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, having 1.5B scoring roughly half of the pretty hard math problems, that still shows some promise for, you know, using this kind of model for solving business problems.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. All right, I'm gonna keep with the trend of small models doing amazing things and reinforcement learning being.
I didn't get the memo, talk. Y'all.
Yeah, you didn't get the memo, man. Yeah. It's okay. No,
you didn't give me a heads up.
You're keeping it diverse. So I want to talk about the S1 model that came out just like, 3 weeks ago? This stands simple test time scaling. You know, if I was going to put a tagline on this, and this would be incredibly powerful reasoning models on the cheap, okay? And this is researchers from Stanford, University of Washington, Allen Institute for AI, and Contextual AI. So it was a joint effort. They open sourced everything, the model, the data, the code, and that's a big deal. There are two main strategies that they took to train this model. One was they created a really small, compact, high quality data set for training, for fine tuning. Mm-hmm. And then they implemented this just shockingly simple, novel technique that they call budget forcing. Okay. Huh. And let's talk about the performance really quickly. This fine tuned model outperformed again OpenAI's O1 preview on math benchmarks. It got 27% improvement over O1 on that. I want to talk about the data set, the training data set. So the researchers curated a data set of just 1,000 training examples, a really challenging, diverse questions, and they were paired with really detailed reasoning traces. And that's going to be important. We're going to come back to that. And then the selection was guided by three criteria: difficulty, diversity, and quality. And they trained the model, you know, they fine-tuned the model on this, and then they did that crazy budget forcing technique that I mentioned. And that is really sort of two parts. One is they would truncate the model. They would basically force it to stop generating tokens if it exceeded some output size, just basically saying that was too much. Mm-hmm. And the other one was that they would inject essentially like weight tokens. So wait, let me think about that. So if the model generated the output and stopped, they would manually essentially inject weight. The model then would look at that and on its own developed reasoning capabilities where it took that weight prompting as a reason to go and reassess its input. And it manifested these strong reasoning capabilities. And what's crazy about this is that I think it was roughly the same amount of money. I think they said it was $6,000 to train it on this 1,000 example data set to get this incredible performance. And I just read yesterday that they have a new version, S1.1, and this is really cool.
It's been days.
It's been days. This is really cool. They had significant improvements in performance, even though it was trained on the exact same 1,000 questions. The difference was they used R1 reasoning traces instead of Gemini reasoning traces, which just speaks to how strong R1 is. And they got a substantial boost, a 60%. They achieved 60% accuracy on the associated math benchmark. So again, just sticking with this theme of, you know, strong base models, small, highly curated,
Reasoning traces
are all you need, and then you get this emergent behavior. So I'm just really, really excited about these new advancements. Okay, we've got so much more to cover, Michael. I'm going to throw it right to you.
All right, so I'm not talking about efficiency at all.
All right, good. Keep it varied.
So I think this is kind of unhinged, but it's really, really interesting. There's a Chinese research group at Renmin University. You probably have to correct me on the pronunciation.
Renmin University. Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, very close.
And then Ant Group, you know, I think they were kind of sponsoring everything. But they used diffusion to train a language model from scratch.
Oh, yeah, that one.
I saw this paper, haven't read it. I'm really interested in this one.
Yeah, it's kind of wacky. I think it's really interesting. It's natural. There's been this ping pong between computer vision and natural language processing for years.
Yep.
And it was only a matter of time before someone just pulled another innovation across the across the line, so to speak. But it's exactly what it sounds like. I mean, if you know how diffusion works in computer vision, there are some nuances. It's a little different. But, you know, there's a forward and a reverse diffusion process. And instead of it being this additive noise that they're adding, it's more of a discrete process where they're masking tokens at random.
Okay. So they're not, I guess you could think about that as a form of binary noise or something like that. But they're essentially masking it. And that's kind of the noise that it has to learn the distribution of to undo.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's exactly right. So unlike autoregressive models, this is something that has, you know, the full context of the input sequence. It's not unidirectional in the generation step.
Okay.
And since they mask these, there's a unique mask token that they add to it. They train this model to reverse that. And in order to have the inference process mimic how they're doing this additive noise.
Yeah, because how would you do that?
I know it sounds kind of wacky. What they do is they will look at this input sequence, they'll immediately try to predict every single mask token. And then at random, based on confidences, they will remask and then refine iteratively until, and that's sort of like an inference budget sort of step.
Okay, that makes sense.
And then you can imagine that during the pre-training process, you can randomly mask any tokens in the sequence.
Right.
But at inference time, if you're in a chat interface, the mask tokens are just the output. And the input is unmasked completely.
Right. Entirely.
That all makes sense so far?
Super interesting. I wonder how they generate arbitrarily long output.
That's a good question. So much like inputs any other LLM that we have today, there's a context window.
Mm-hmm.
And the output, they'll try to generate tokens within the entire budget, but they also have an end of sequence token that the model will inject there. So there's just a bunch of garbage tokens after that, as I understand it.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. All right, this
interesting.
This follows the theme of recent AI advancements of what if we tried technique A with technique B and we just mashed them together? Like, there's just so much we haven't even tried yet.
There's nothing crazy about it. I mean, it's literally just like we're looking at a menu of algorithmic advances from the last however many years.
Yeah.
And it's that I will mention it was, so they did it at the 8 billion parameter size and they compared it to Llama. They tried to keep everything as one for one as possible. And it's worth noting that all the benchmarks, all the performance is roughly the same. Like there's nothing materially different between the two. But the one big innovation that they talked about here, which makes total sense, is that there's kind of like a directional bias with these next token prediction models, these autoregressive models. And then there's this reversal curse that happens where, you know, if you ask, they use Chinese poems as an example. But if you have, you know, the first line of a stanza and you ask it to predict the second one, you know, GPT-4o can do great and it, you know, nails it. But if you do the reverse and say, here's the answer, predict the previous line, it just totally botches it because there's a, you know, there's a bias in the way that it's trained.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes complete sense.
You don't really have that problem with this one.
Okay.
So,
oh, it's amazing that they made it work and, you know, the model is so accurate.
Yeah, I think it's wild. And, I mean, I don't think it's going to be this revolutionary technique or anything. I mean, I think it's...
very early.
Yeah, it's very early. And when you think about how reasoning happens in the natural world, like sequence links in modern inference are just naturally getting longer and longer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And reasoning is an inherently sequential process. And, you know, this transition,
well, I mean,
you know.
So what's really interesting about that is... it's a sequential process for us. I wonder if it's like theoretically must be sequential. Like I'm like, one of the things I was wondering about is with this diffusion approach, you know, could it almost come out with all of it at inference time, you know, kind of fully baked, right? You know, the way I think about it is imagine you are trying to articulate some point and that semantic concept is just some point in this high dimensional embedding space, right? If you could just uncompress that instantly, right, it wouldn't necessarily need to be a reasoning process. The reason I say that is often find that, you know, sometimes the greatest insights just appear like a bolt out of the blue, right? They just all of a sudden they manifest in your brain and you don't necessarily think through them a piece at a time. All right,
maybe
one more,
this is a spontaneous insight model.
Yeah, it could be. All right, one more question about this. Are there any differences in like inference cost? Is it faster or anything like that? Is it all pretty much the same?
That's a very good question. So you can play with the budget. You can trade sample quality for, because it's a diffusion model.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. You can change the number of denoising steps.
Okay.
But they're basically on par. I mean, if you use the same, actually, well, I will say, what they compared in the paper was the training budget, performance on big benchmarks relative to how many flops you budgeted for training.
Yeah.
I might have missed it, but I didn't see a whole lot in there about the inference step. I would imagine that could be super, super expensive depending on what you're doing.
Yeah.
But that's still an open question for me too.
Okay. Okay. All right. That's the love it. And thank you for staying away from reinforcement learning.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome.
All right, ZZ, you're up.
I like to talk about Minecraft.
All right.
It's a little long. Bear with me a little bit. There's this project called Project Cid, you know, Cid Civilization. It's actually from last November. Basically, you know, the researchers placed about like 1,000 AI agents in a Minecraft server, let them spawn in a village or a couple of villages, and then initialized them actually pretty identically. Like, you know, they all have the same kind of personality. They all have the same goal, which is survival with your fellow citizens. And then what emerged was the, you know, their own civilization with government, culture, and economy.
No way.
I just thought that's...
No way. How the hell did this not make my newsletters? Are you kidding me?
It's super interesting. It's not open source, though. It's a commercial project, it seems like. But, you know, that really excites me because, you know, I'm excited about world models and its application to train RL agents.
Here we go.
Because once you have the, you know, what drove the deep learning and transformer kind of revolution was the part of it is great large scale data. Mm-hmm. But for RL, what's the great data for RL? To me, it means the, you know, high quality environments.
Right.
So this goes along that direction. So I'm pretty excited about that. Happy to dive into some juicy details, but yeah.
All right. I mean, how were the agents, like, do the agents have like a a neural network that controls their behavior, and then that is optimized. Is there a policy in place? How do they interact?
How to train?
Like, yeah, like everything.
What's the architecture of the agent?
Exactly, everything.
Great question. I think they released a technical report. From my understanding, they didn't release the code, but there's a technical report. From my own understanding, it's LLM based. So I don't think there's training. They're not like training the agents, but they're just executing the agents, let them driven by LLMs. And they implemented several modules. There's memory module, action awareness module, goal generation module to set their own goals, social awareness module, which I will talk more about later.
Okay,
it's very interesting.
That doesn't make sense. Okay.
Talking module and the skills module, because you know, in Minecraft, you need to have multiple skills.
Is it playing out in real time?
Or they good question. I don't actually know. They might, you know, call the Minecraft API. I don't know how you actually do it, actually.
Yeah, because having real-time inference for a really complicated agent setup like that sounds pretty constraining,
right?
Unless you could just slow down time and a slower frame rate or something.
Yeah, I would imagine it's probably not real-time, like, you know, calling LLM to generate the next action.
Yeah, okay.
Take some time. But yeah, super great question. Yeah, one interesting finding that they have is the emergence of specialization thanks to the social module. So they did some experiment, you know, without social module, the setting is the same. All the agents are spawned with the identical personality, identical goal. When you add social awareness module, which means ability to predict other agents' sentiment towards you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. By having that, there is the emergence of specialization. You know, some agents would specialize in mining, some specialize in farming.
Wow.
You know, things like that. But without a social awareness module, you cannot, you know, the stable specialization did not appear.
Okay, that's fascinating. That is fascinating. In grad school, we studied something that was called evolutionarily stable strategies, ESSs. Mm. And it's you would basically build these virtual worlds, and you would have all these, you know, these agents or creatures running around, and you would study what type of strategies, you know, behavioral strategies would be stable. For example, if you put all these creatures together and every one of them just lied and backstabbed each other constantly, mm-hmm. that wasn't stable. But if you had the creatures just be completely trusting of everything, well, that wasn't very stable either. They quickly died out. So you had to have this, it was this sort of constant non-equilibrium between trust and lack of trust work together.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense. I was wondering, why would they develop these goals or these behaviors, and how would they have stability in an environment like that? Sounds like it's the social module.
Yeah. I think I also find that to be super interesting. Another finding that they have around the social awareness module is that when you have that, there's also the emergence of long-term social relationship, which otherwise wouldn't, you know, didn't appear.
Wow.
Like it's the stable social relationship. Like, you know, they visualized the graph where, you know, you can see that Zoe, it's the virtual agent Zoe, doesn't like Lucas. And, you know, Mia and Enza, Clara, you know, they're very cozy, you know, very stable kind of social graph there. Super interesting.
All right. That's awesome.
That is wicked cool, ZZ.
I love it. All right. Well, you know what? I'm gonna talk about something kind of related. It's at least in the biology space. My next topic is, and this is hot off the press. So this is this week. Actually, I mentioned this every week on LinkedIn. On Fridays, I kind of collect what I think are the top AI news stories. And this week, I think, is number one. And this is a model called Evo2. And this is from the ARC Institute. This is the largest foundational AI model ever built for biology. It's got 40 billion parameters, 1 million token context length. I personally think this is a game changer, right? It was trained on 9.3 trillion nucleotides. So nucleotides are the building block of DNA. So DNA is comprised of four separate nucleotides, ACGT. It was trained on over 128,000 genomes, and it covered all three domains of life: bacteria, Archaea, and eukaryotes. And it can design entirely new chromosomes and small genomes from scratch, and can also interpret complex DNA, and this is really important, including non-coding gene variants leaked diseases. Here's one example. It has the ability to achieve over 90% accuracy in distinguishing between benign and potentially harmful mutations in the BRCA1 gene, which is highly associated with breast cancer. So for me, this is a huge win for AI-driven science. I think that this is the most important thing that happened this week. You guys know I'm a real big computational biology guy, so I'm super, super excited about that one. All right, so I just wanted to mention that really quickly. That's hot off the press. Mike, I'm throwing back to you.
All right, I'll keep this one relatively short too. Or not. Just so I think it'd be interesting to just talk about this new gold medalist model, this Alpha Geometry 2 model that came from DeepMind. So I think it was last August we talked about Alpha Geometry 1, which had achieved silver. And at the time it was a really big deal. We were excited. We talked about it here on the show. But DeepMind's done it again. They have this new iteration of it, Alpha Geometry 2. And to just the highlight reel, they went from 66% on the on their final score to 88%, which bumps you into the gold medal and puts you on par with, you know, upper echelon human performance at this high school level. So I think it's worth mentioning that Google, DeepMind, I really appreciate that they're going after science specifically.
Yes.
You know, they're taking this sort of like narrow domain specific kind of approach that has really sparse rewards. But if you can imagine, you know, if they just have build one model that cures cancer, I mean, the rewards are untold, and it's a very great strategy. And it's diametrically opposed to someone like OpenAI, who I would say they're just trying to do everything, which isn't necessarily a worse or better strategy, but going after artificial superintelligence and just racing to scale as fast as you can.
Right, right.
That might take longer than it would take to take this, you know, scientific approach.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, the progress towards AGI is incredibly important, but right now the sort of maybe more domain specific AI that's being developed by DeepMind, I think, is hands down for me the most important and exciting work being done in AI.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. We need to find something we disagree on, but I don't know if that's it.
I love it. Okay. That was nice and short. Zizi, what you got?
I could talk about, there's a new paper coming from Apple and Oxford University about distilling. The paper's name is called Distilling Scaling Laws. And I think it's helpful for guiding strategy as to how do you allocate your training budget or your budget towards, you know, either pre-training a big model, distill it into a small model, or should you focus more just on training a small model? So they provided some great details as to, you know, how should you think about the problem, in what conditions should you prioritize, you know, either one of them. I think that's super helpful. So in the paper, they mentioned something called compute optimal distillation. That's a really, I think that's a really worth, it's a graph that's worth, really worth looking at. My understanding of it on the high level is that, you know, so here's the decision point. If the inference of the large teacher model is kind of free or accounted for, or like you don't have to need to pay for it, or you know, you use the teacher, or if the inference of the teacher model is in your product already, like it already serves your user, then by all means train the teacher model, and then distill it into the student model. It's beneficial anyway. But if that's not the case, like, you know, if you're starting from scratch and your teacher model is only used to distill the student model, then it's not worth it. It's better to just allocate all the resources to training a really strong student model a really long time.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So in other words, Anthropic and OpenAI, Perplexity, they should just stick with the course, but we on the other side should just train student models. Or distill models, right?
I like the discussion. I actually don't know. Like I feel like, you know, if it's a sunk cost, like the big model is already there and other people have already downloaded the reasoning traces, well, I might as well just use that. But if I work in a new domain, For example, I don't know biology or any other domain that the general LLM is not trained on yet. Then should I start from training a large teacher model, distill it, or should I just keep, you know, pick a half a billion model and train it really, really well? I feel like maybe that points to the latter.
Got it.
Okay.
But that's only my personal thought.
Okay. That's I haven't read that paper yet. That's really interesting. I've got to get my head around it a little bit more. It's kind of interesting that we're already having these type of conversations though, right? That the scaling law conversations are now going down to around distillation.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. My final topic, this is a little bit more of almost like an opinion piece. So you guys push back on this.
Okay.
I'm really excited about this renewed focus on reinforcement learning, especially with, I think it's a couple of things, especially with this use of stronger base models as a starting point and sort of verifiable domains being used to bootstrap them. Reinforcement learning has been around for a really long time. And this goes all the way back, I think it was like 1992 with the, what was it? TD Gammon. Yeah, it was like the backgammon solution. They use reinforcement learning to essentially play backgammon, 33 years ago. When I was in grad school in the 90s, reinforcement learning was very exotic and really not something, that we thought about using because it was so expensive. And it was almost like GANs. It was like, it was very unwieldy.
Unstable.
Unstable. And it was just really, really problematic. And now we're seeing what I think of as this really breakthrough in the last 6 months. And I think OpenAI maybe had identified this a little bit earlier, but it was behind closed doors. R1 in particular has really, really unlocked this. And I think that this combination of verifiable domains, we're still using reinforcement learning with human feedback, is going to be taking off. And the reason is just as simple. I think we now have models with, we have base open source models that are strong enough that this technique, just this pure RL at scale, is going to be really, really powerful. And this is what I think. This is where I think we're going. I think we're going to end up in an environment where we're going to have more and more verifiable domains because right now, let's say for the most part, math and coding are the leading verifiable domains, right? As we develop more powerful models, they can act as verifiers, right? Mm-hmm. Almost like large language model as judge. Mm. And it's going to, in my opinion, I think we're going to see this expanding scope of verifiable domains that all of them are model backed. And so you're going to have these foundational reasoning models that are going to have incredibly diverse domain capabilities. And then rinse and repeat, right? Now we're standing at that level. And with the efficiencies, one of the themes of today's talk was the efficiencies, $5,000 to fine tune a model, and get reasoning. I think we're going to see a huge jump in capabilities at reasonable costs, still millions of dollars, but not billions of dollars coming soon. So I think for the first time in my life, I'm really excited about RL as a general tool. And I'll end with this kind of think piece with a couple things. One is, I love, Kapathy had this comment a few weeks ago, and I think you both know what I'm going to say, which is, he said there are essentially two types of learning. There's imitation learning, which is like learning by watching, and you can think about children doing that. And then there's trial and error learning, and that's essentially reinforcement learning. And he points out that all of the really most amazing breakthroughs and surprises have come from the second type. And I think most famously AlphaGo and Move 37, this move in the game against Lisa Dahl, the world champion, that was so unexpected that that some people thought it was a bug, that the model had, you know, lost its mind. But it's now we look back and we realize that human players, that we'd been sort of locked into a small area of possible strong ghost strategies that we'd kind of, you know, got into a closed think loop, and the model expanded that. And so I'm just really, really excited about this. I think that it's going to unlock fronts in a really, really big way. All right, so that's, I'm going to shut up now. That's my thought on RL. What do you guys think? You agree? You disagree?
I totally agree. I'm going to maybe throw out a very debatable idea, and you probably don't, you may not agree with this. I feel like world models may be the main or the key innovation area that can drive this trend.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah,
like all the businesses, you know, if I'm in a product company and I work on recommendation engine algorithms, what if I can build a simulation or world models of the consumers, their buying behavior, browsing behavior, and use them to generate the clickstream data to verify my ranking algorithm or recommendation algorithm? I think that'll be a game changer. So
okay, I think you literally just, anybody listening, that is a product company idea right there.
Take note.
That is a $1 billion AI product company idea right there, dude.
I'm excited about this, but I'm not sure, you know, how feasible, like, you know, how do you think about this? Is it feasible, or do you think, like, you know, maybe the algorithm or data or, like, you know, the compute is more important to focus on?
I think that makes a ton of sense because, you know, let's stick with the recommendation engine thing. You know, what's really interesting about that is traditionally, and I would say maybe even up till now, you have the cold start problem, right? That won't be a problem soon. If I'm going to sort of channel your thought there. If you have a world model and it comes in and it understands sort of the normal distributions of likes and dislikes and understands the world, understands that maybe somebody living in a very cold place, you know, isn't going to be interested in buying a bathing suit. You know what I mean? Right? Like just common knowledge would be huge in a situation like that. I'm 100% convinced you're right about that, ZZ.
Stands to reason to me.
Please tame my enthusiasm.
No, I'm totally with you. And I think it's great too, because, you know, we've lived in a world for years at this point at Kung Fu AI where when you show up at a client's doorstep and they have this grand vision, but they have no data to train on, it's almost always a showstopper unless we can find some synthetic data generation process
or we can
go elsewhere and find some analogous data set that at least can help us bootstrap and then have some human assisted label correction or something. Like, that is always really tough to get through. But if, you know, we live in this world, like you're mentioning, that just comes with all this, you know, pre-baked intuition about how the world works and can reasonably kickstart that, you know, lack of data, the data shortage. I mean, sounds like the future would be great.
I completely agree.
And you don't need it. I mean, 'cause you think about it, humans kind of are that. I mean, there's a reason humans are the expert annotators for companies that need data.
That's right.
Because they are these general purpose machines.
That's
that
right.
I shouldn't say machines. But you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, we understand the world and we intuitively know, you know, this person lives in a cold place. They need some gloves. And I don't see it in any of their previous carts.
Right. And we're in this temporary point in time, which sounds weird to say, but I think it's going to be pretty temporary where we have models that may be able to approach human capabilities on some domains, but if you go outside that domain, so for example, you think about product recommendations, right? Like, let's stick there. You may have a really strong domain-specific product recommendation model, but the second you ask it for, like, a medical opinion or a legal opinion, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, worse. Less than useful, right? That's not going to be the case anymore. What we're going to have is we're going to have base models that not only have, like, the entire sum knowledge of human history, but they're going to be domain experts across the board. And that's going to be the starting point for every project, for every product, for every company, for every feature you're dealing with.
Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting, too, thinking about the future. I mean, because there's still a lot of science to be done. You know, Dario, the CEO of Anthropic, I read that piece that Machines of Loving Grace piece mm-hmm. he had. It was just kind of general thoughts about artificial general intelligence, superintelligence. And in that, he was talking about how, you know, in the future, even if you have the most perfect Oracle model that knows everything, there are still observations about the world that we haven't made mm-hmm. as humans. You know, there's a reason scientists still go out there and collect data on particular domains that they, mm-hmm. there's just no recorded data for. So I think it'd be also be interesting if an Oracle like that or a, you know, world model that just understands everything that we've at least recorded can then interact with the environment to right. go close gaps in understanding. And
yeah, yep. totally agree.
Super interesting.
Awesome. I love it. Okay. I'm going to call it there, guys. That was a lot. Thank you so much as usual.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
us. A lot of fun.
All right.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.